If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/wondery and use code wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 932. This episode brought to you by Squarespace. Destiny is calling, and Destiny is saying you need a new website. Why is Destiny nagging you? Because it wants you to make a thing, and it wants you to do it at Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Showcase your work. You can publish, you can blog, you can sell products, you can sell services, announce events, whatever it is. Squarespace does this by giving you beautiful templates created by world-class designers, very powerful e-commerce functionality, which lets you sell anything online. You can customize the look, feel, settings, products, just a few clicks. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. It's a new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions and analytics to help you grow in real time. There's built-in SEO, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. Make it stand out. Stand out with a beautiful website. Katie, these website things, they're here to stay.
They're a little important. A little bit.
That needs to be their, that needs to be their tagline.
Websites.
They're a little important. Check out squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T, that's ID, the number 10, and T, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Just imagine 10 and ID10T and 10%. That's how that works. That's yep. Serendipity.
10 and 10.
10 and 10.
Still equals 10.
10 for 10. let's see. What's going on the corkboard? Well, I'm going to be performing at the Brea Improv this weekend, which is February, I think, 16, 17.
Yeah.
And then the following weekend at Levity Live in Oxnard. Just Google it. what do you have on the corkboard?
Well, first I want to remind people we have a new corkboard email. It's corkboard@id10t.com. And then this one is actually something I found that I just thought was so cool. I wanted to share. So I recently bought a cast iron pan and I had to get a skillet mitt for it.
Okay.
And so I went on Etsy to look for some and I found this shop called Collisionware, run by this woman who makes the greatest oven mitts, pot holders, skillet mitts, everything ever. Like she has so many different fabrics. They're all super cute.
Okay.
Mine has little baby bears and deer all over it and foxes. And I just wanted to share it because I love it so much. And it's Etsy.com/shop/collisionware. And that's WARE. I also want to plug Pete Holmes' show Crashing on HBO.
Do it. Plug it.
Sunday nights. This Sunday is a really important episode to Pete. He's trying to get as many people as he can to watch it. He really is hoping to get picked up for a season 3. So please watch Crashing this Sunday night because it's going to be a really fun and important episode.
Make it weird and watch Crashing.
Yeah.
Watch Pete Holmes. Watch your buddy Pete Holmes.
Everyone loves Pete.
Make a thing. This episode is... a dear old friend, not old, he's not old, I mean, it's like we've been friends for a long time, John August. We've been friends for a couple decades now. John August is an amazing writer. Just look at IMDb at all the insane stuff that he's written. But not only is he just a really sweet guy and a really interesting writer, but he also, I'm sorry, not only is he a really sweet guy and incredibly talented writer, but he's also an excellent communicator for the writing process. So he has been online basically counseling, you know, writers and young writers for years and years and years and years since blogging was ever a thing. And he is so, so, so incisive and smart and has such great ideas. He's written a novel called Arlo Finch and the Valley of Fire. And his new podcast, Launch, is on Wondery. And it's all about how he wrote this book and a lot of his writing process. So Go listen to that and enjoy his book and all of his movie projects, and enjoy him now on the ID10T podcast number 932. It's August in February. I'm a moron.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
In the beginning, there were a few of, like, the handheld, like, Tascam or Sony, you know, but they were really for, like, serious...
Yeah, like production sound mixers.
Serious production sound mixers. And, yeah, Zoom had been around for a couple of years, and it was just one of those things where, like, oh, well, these are inexpensive.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, they sound amazing.
They sound really good.
And, like, even the Zoom... Even the H1, mm-hmm. which is, like, the old one...
Still sounds good.
It's tiny and sounds great. So, they've done a good job. Way to go, Zoom Capital. And now you see, like, the H4Ns mm-hmm. on boomsticks.
Totally,
like, people use them on productions.
Or they mount them, like, to a DSLR as, like, the actual production sound. Like,
yeah.
They'll slot it in there, so...
Yeah, boy, I really wish I'd been smart enough back in those days to go, maybe I should see if I can invest in this company.
That'd be great, yeah.
You know, I just wasn't.
Well, the question is, what are the things right now that you're using that you're not thinking to invest in? That's the question. Because there's going to be something like, you're like, oh, that's really great, and you don't think to invest in it.
You know what? Time with other people in real life.
Aww.
Come on, you guys.
Nicely done, yes.
What is a nice... That's actually not true. No, it is true. I do, you know, I don't know if I, because you have a 12-year-old and you're very busy. Do you have to force yourself to go out or do you, are you?
Yeah.
Kind
so
of-
for the first couple years of my daughter's life, we would do the thing where we had a standing sort of date night. So on Tuesday nights and Saturday nights, we'd always have a sitter. So we would like feel kind of forced to leave the house and go out and do stuff. And then we moved away to Paris for a year, and we just moved back over the summer.
Fancy.
Which was fancy. So we moved back, and we sort of got rid of our nanny to do that sort of like that date night thing. And I do miss it. It was great.
Well, it sounds unsexy as a process, but when you get older, you kind of do have to schedule like date nights and leisure time and all mm-hmm. that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because otherwise you just don't think to do it, or you get caught up.
Yeah, the inertia of just staying put, I mean, is what's going to happen. And you're like, I'm tired, I want to go to bed. But if you already have a sitter coming on Tuesday night, like, okay, no, we're going to at least go out to dinner and like have a conversation that does not involve sort of like, you know, diapers and such things.
I know. Well, we're not at the diaper conversations yet.
Yeah.
But we've only been married a year.
Congratulations on getting married, by the way.
Thanks.
On Instagram, it looked beautiful.
Oh, it was incredible. It was great. It was the best wedding I've ever been to.
Mm-hmm.
What if I was like, it was the third best wedding I've ever been to? No, it really was, though. Really, I mean, I think we really did our best to try to imagine what it was like for the wedding attendee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to.
Which I think sometimes isn't always the case. Where it's like, oh, you got to go to France for this wedding. And then you got to buy this certain clothing. And
absolutely.
Then
there's just the color scheme.
Yeah, and you got to, you know. And so we did. We're like... Quick ceremony, you know, cocktail pre-party, quick ceremony, right to the party, no speeches, no phones.
Oh, nice.
We did no phones, and it was great.
Yeah.
It was really great.
That's great.
This is just for the audience. It's not like I'm telling you something you already know. I've known you for 20 years.
Yes.
I met you when you were writing a show called DC mm-hmm. that my... ex-girlfriend Jacinda was on, and you were writing that, and you, at that point, you had, Go already had come out, as far as I remember.
Yeah, Go had come out, or maybe
Go
just come
Go is
out.
A great fucking movie.
Thank you very much. It was
that
first movie. Yeah.
Holds up. Go holds up.
Yeah, thank you.
And what a cast.
No, we had a ridiculously good cast.
Tim Olyphant, mm-hmm. Melissa McCarthy, and like her first movie role.
Yes.
And she was great.
She's fantastic. You got Scott Wolf.
Scott Wolf, Sarah Polley.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is...
Tay Diggs.
And Go is also... was very much... it captured a certain vibe of the moment, but the movie is still like it's. There's some movies when you look back and you go, oh, I don't know, that's really just for that period of time. And Go really holds up. You did such a great job
Thank
with
you
it.
Very
I'm,
much.
So, I'm so happy.
I'll say one thing that, I mean, it's very true to the time, but when younger people watch the movie, they're like, well, why doesn't she just like call
up? Okay, so, well, there's that.
And so people say like, well, didn't they have cell phones? And like, they didn't, it's hard to explain. Like, cell phones were a brand new thing. And so like, you know, Adam and Zach, they would have a cell phone because they were just rich enough to have a cell phone. But like, Sarah Polley's character would not have had a cell phone at that age. And at that time.
They were shockingly expensive, and then you had to navigate the, like, all right, so it's 25 cents a minute, and I'll, you know, I'll pay a ton of money just to, you know, and who am I going to call? Like, they're, you know, a drug dealer, perhaps, or a business person.
Yeah, that's it.
Not that drug dealers aren't business people. They just operate.
We're all small businesses.
You know, they're entrepreneurs with a little bit extra go, I guess. I don't know. But that movie was great, and the tone of it was so great. But I kind of want to walk people through, because the other reason I'm excited to have you on the podcast is you're also a fantastic kind of unofficial educator at the same time. And you have, you know, like you shared your knowledge for so long on what we formerly called weblogs.
Yes.
And now you're doing a podcast. But you've written so many great things that I'm sure people know. But Go was your first thing.
Go was the first. And then the second thing I was actually in production on was DC, this television show that Jacinda was on.
Dick Wolf.
Me and Dick Wolf. And so the real show should have been me and Dick Wolf, like shouting at each other full volume down hallways. And so you saw me during sort of that long extended car crash of that TV show. And I just loved this cast. I loved the writers I had. But it was the show should never have happened. And so you and I would be flying up to Toronto. You'd be up there to visit Jacinda. I'd be up there to visit the set. And I think you saw, like, I was just melting down. Like, I could not handle the stress of it all. And I'm trying to juggle all these things and keep this show in the air. And it was just, I was having these out-of-body experiences where, like, I was watching myself have these conversations, yet the real John August was somewhere else just observing the whole thing.
Now, what were they sort of forcing you to try to do? What was the toxic nature of it?
I think some of it is just the nature of trying to do a full-on series. And so I had no experience trying to, like, run a writing staff, how to, you know, run post. And then we had this crazy idea that, okay, well, we want to shoot exteriors in D.C. So in order to be able to do that, we had to shoot cheaper in Toronto. And so we would fly this triangle of, like, I would go to Toronto, then to D.C., then back to Los Angeles. And I was trying to do all this while writing the show, and it just didn't work.
And this was for the WB, was that correct?
Yeah, it was for the WB. It was one of the last shows for the WB.
Before it became the CW. Yeah, so the WB. So basically it was a group of 20-somethings who were kind of living, loving, working in Washington. Mm-hmm. Dick Wolf, of course, tremendous success with Law & Order.
Yeah.
And then it was sort of his foray into, can I do programming for younger people on a different network? Mm-hmm. And then it didn't work, and then he just went back and made a ton of more Law & Orders.
Yeah. So it's a question of, like, you know, could you – it's basically Felicity after college was sort of the pitch for the show.
Right.
And, you know, I was probably a pretty good person to write that show. Dick Wolf was not a good partner for me to be working on that show with, and we just never saw eye to eye. And so it was really rough. So I remember getting off one of those flights from D.C., and getting the call from an agent that they'd fired me, and just feeling such tremendous relief. just that, like, you know, just all this weight had come off me. And I mean, I felt bad for the people who were still stuck on the show, like Melissa McCarthy, who had cast on the show and was stuck on the show that she never wanted to be on.
Right.
But and Jacinda and everyone else. But I was free, and it was great.
You know, I mean, when I first met Melissa, you know, she was Missy, and she, because she was Jenny McCarthy's cousin, she came out and she was basically a PA on Jenny's sketch show at MTV. And I remember meeting her and hanging out with her and just being like, holy, you're so fucking funny. Like, she was legit funny. And then finding out, like, oh, she had all this insane improv and sketch training in Chicago. And just sort of feeling like, shouldn't you kind of have a sketch going? And then now, of course, there she's one of the most famous people in the comedy people in the world.
Yeah.
And That was always a story that made me happy, because I felt like, aha, the universe does reward funny. It does reward talented people. And she, you know, but seeing her and even in that tiny scene she had in Go.
Oh, yeah.
She made it hilarious with just a tiny little thing.
So right after Go, you know, I wasn't there when we shot her scene, but I saw the dailies. I'm like, oh my God, she's fantastic. So I sort of hunted her down. I found her at a Starbucks in my neighborhood. It turned out she lived in my neighborhood. And I said, like, I'm writing a short for us to make together. And so I did that. And that was a little short called God. And that became her reel for a while. And that sort of got her onto Gilmore Girls and other stuff. And like people loved that tape and just passed it around. And then I was able to make a movie with her later on. And she's just the best. And when good things happen to good people, it does give you some faith in the universe that things work out right.
Yeah, because it's nice. It's always the thing that one of the things that I really do enjoy is watching, you know, everyone that you knew very early on, and just not only watching them blossom, but in the ways that they blossom, mm-hmm. and like, oh, how are they going to express their talent? What little corner of the business are they going to find? And you know, watching the rest of the world kind of discover this thing that you already knew, which mm-hmm. is, yeah, this person is a gem. It's an undiscovered gem. And then seeing that really, really hit is that part of the fun process for you as a writer, is sort of discovering that stratum of creative types?
I always love sort of watching people who I know are going to make it, and sort of, you sort of recognize the patterns of like, okay, I see what you're doing. The thing you're doing is really good. People are going to notice that it's really good. But you're not waiting around to be lucky. You are going out there and you are putting yourself in places where people can discover how good you are.
Right.
And that's amazing. So I've been lucky that some of my former assistants have gone on to do amazing things. Like Rawson Thurber ended up doing Dodgeball. Mm-hmm. He did the Terry Tate Office Linebacker commercial, which mm-hmm. was the sort of breakout thing. But I remember sort of him going through and sort of just working and iterating on these ideas and like figuring out what unique thing does he have to say. And once he figured out that his sort of little space, he was not afraid to sort of put it out there and just shoot it and find a way to make it. And I think so many people talk about like, oh, one day I'm going to do this thing. It's the people who actually just do the thing that sort of make their next one days.
I always bug people about that in the show. I'm just like, make your thing, make your goddamn thing. Mm-hmm. But as a writer, I feel like you have a little bit of an edge over someone who is an actor, mm-hmm. say, because if you're a writer, technically, you can just go to Starbucks and write.
Yeah.
It's like you can't go to Starbucks and start acting.
No, I mean, writers need no permission to do their craft, which is great. And so
people forget that, though.
Yeah. But so I remember that originally I perceived you only as a performer because I'd seen you as a game show host. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until I was reading a good article in Wired. I'm like, oh, this is really good. And I flip back and it's like, oh, Chris wrote this. Then I realized, like, oh, you're actually a writer. And like, and I don't even know when that transition happened, but like you sort of figured out who you were after I sort of first met you.
And then, oh, yeah, yeah, it was after. It was way after. It was like 10 years after.
And so I remember like you and I had, I think I emailed you and then we ended up having a lunch or something at BLD and sort of catching up a little bit. And then I bump into you at Chipotle and other places. And it was always been great to see like, oh, yeah, this is a guy who figured out who he is and how to do the things he really loves and make that his career. And it's been great to watch you.
Well, I appreciate that. But saying before about asking for permission, it was weirdly something that didn't occur to me that I could do until like 13 years into my career. I do credit the internet with...
Yeah.
If it hadn't been for the internet, I can't say that it would have occurred to me that, oh, I can go just create things and make them directly mm-hmm. for an audience. I wouldn't have known how to do that otherwise. But, you know, your website was... The stories you were sharing about writing and the process was also very inspirational because it is that idea of like, you just got to do it.
Yeah.
You just have to do it. You know, I think people do think there's some kind of a secret thing that has to happen.
That there's a secret society that like, you know, you have to learn the handshake and then you get into this next
thing.
It's
very unsexy. You just wake up and start doing it one day.
Yeah. And I think I always get frustrated by the terminology of like breaking into Hollywood as if there's like a wall around the whole thing. And once you scale the wall and you're inside, it's like, and our experience is like, that's just not how it is. You just start doing stuff and eventually people recognize the thing you're doing. You're helping out people while they're doing their stuff. And eventually it all kind of works out. And, you know, the people who have been most helpful to me throughout my entire career aren't like the powerful people who are making decisions. It's the folks who are exactly at my level mm-hmm. doing the kinds of things that I'm doing. And I help them out and they help me out and we all sort of grow together.
Well, I want to, let's sort of quickly walk through, you know, like all of the Tim Burton years mm-hmm. and how that relationship developed, because, you know, I'm sure if people just look on IMDb, but you wrote Big Fish, you wrote Corpse Bride, you did the screenplay for Frankenweenie too, I think, right? So you've done a lot of You've worked a lot with Tim Burton, and obviously Tim seems to be a guy that once he finds people mm-hmm. that really he connects with, he just likes yeah. to collaborate with him a lot. So what? How did you guys get together? And then the follow-up question after that, just to mentally prepare you, is when you're working with someone who has such a strong point of view like Tim, mm-hmm. how do you not get absorbed? How does your point of view not get yeah. absorbed by that?
So the Tim Burton thing is interesting because people perceive that we must have this great relationship and that we're hanging out all the time. And I've spent probably a total of 60 hours in Tim's presence over the course of all of these movies. It's a very, very limited period of time. So I had read the book version of Big Fish when it was in manuscript form, just a box of pages. And I had overnight to read it and see if I wanted to try to attach myself to write it for one studio, for Sony, which is who had done Go. They'd just done Go. It hadn't come out yet. And so I read through this book. I was like, oh, I get this. I know how to do this. I know everything I need to change, but I totally understand what it's like to have a father who's dying, who you're trying to figure out how you're going to, you know, sort of come to terms with him. I had made the character my age and the dad, my dad's age, so I could keep the timeline straight. I just knew exactly how to do this. And I'd set up the rights to – so I took it into Sony. I convinced them to buy me this book for not much money. I ended up going off and doing the first Charlie's Angels before that. Mm-hmm. Which was also during the whole DC debacle.
Oh, that's right. You were writing Charlie's Angels at
yes.
the same. Oh yeah, your life was. You know, it's funny. It's like, boy, I just want to write for a living, and you're like, fuck, this is not what I thought it would be. Too much.
That's one of the best days on DC. Was like it was a really tense table reading with Dick Wolfe, and so the cast is all there, and we're on stage, and I would get a call. The PA is like. John, you have a call from Drew Barrymore. I'm like, oh, like,
yeah. Sorry, guys.
So back to Big Fish. So I'd gotten the rights to this book. I went off and wrote the screenplay. It was really hard. I mean, it was a really hard emotional puzzle piece to fit together. But I was really happy with the script. I ended up getting these great producers on it, Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen. They had just done American Beauty. We'd done another pass, and Sony said, like, oh, this is a really beautiful, small, expensive movie. We don't make beautiful, small, expensive movies. And so they said, well, what if we got like a big director? It's like, well, it would have to be Steven Spielberg or somebody. And so we got Spielberg on. So Steven Spielberg was attached to Big Fish for about a year. And so I worked on two drafts with him.
Well, hold on. So then we needed cantaloupes, so we just picked up cantaloupes.
We just picked up, yeah, exactly. Yeah. We picked up the best cantaloupes in the whole world.
We got two cantaloupes, we got a Spielberg, and then some Frosted Flakes. Like, how do you just get Spielberg? They sent it over and
they did.
Liked it.
It was literally like that. So basically, you know, Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen were able to take it to Spielberg. They're like, hey, we got this great script. He's like, yeah, I know how to do that. And so I met with him. That was terrific. That was another situation where we were in the editing room on the first Charlie's Angels. And so I'm there with McGee. And I love McGee, but there were tension. There were lots of plenty of tensions on Charlie's Angels. And at one point, there was a call in his office like, oh, hey, it's Steven Spielberg calling for John. And it's like, ha, sorry, McGee. I got to check the call for Steven Spielberg.
Sorry, I got a royal flush.
Yes.
Thump. There it is.
Steven was fantastic. And I ended up working on a couple other things for him. But we just never sort of came to figure out Big Fish together with him, and he wanted to do other stuff. So he left, and we took it to Tim Burton. Tim Burton said yes, and like a couple months later, we started shooting. So we didn't really work on the script very much together at all. He just like, oh, I like this. Go, we'll make this movie. And so it wasn't until Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was the first time that I was really writing a new thing for him and had to sort of figure out like, okay, this is a movie I'm writing specifically for Tim Burton with in my head, like, okay, what is going to be Burton-esque about this movie, and so I can really write towards his vision, and you know, find the things that were interesting to me about the story that would also interest him about the story.
I mean, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was a headline. This writer, I'm sure, knew what they were doing, but it's a headline that I think about every once in a while, and it makes me giggle. Which was because the movie opened very well, and the headline was. Depp's Chocolate Factory has tasty opening.
Oh, yeah, that's a very Variety headline.
It makes me giggle like a 14-year-old.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
they're like, you guys knew it. You know what you're
tasty
doing.
Opening.
Yeah, you knew. You guys
Little
knew
Chocolate Factory.
You know, yeah. Come on, just yeah, come on. But at that point, are you starting? Do you feel like, okay, this is a partnership that seems like it's going to keep continuing, or are you still working on your own stuff at the same time? How are you balancing writing for Tim and writing for John separately.
Yeah, I wasn't writing a lot of other stuff for myself. I sort of got into a grind where I was hopefully trying to write Tim's next movie and working on some stuff for other directors as well. And I wasn't really focusing on sort of what I wanted to do next. And so I spent a couple of years where I was just sort of doing stuff for other people. And it pays really well, but you don't end up having anything that's ultimately yours. I was lucky that the Tim Burton movies sort of back-to-back were getting made, which is great, because so much of what a screenwriter does can just get lost. I've written probably 50 scripts, and I've been lucky that 12 of them have shot, but there's so many other movies that are just stuck in 12-point career on a shelf someplace. And so the Tim Burton movies mostly got made. A couple of them didn't. I did this movie for Tim called Monsterpocalypse, which ended up being just too similar to Pacific Rim. Like, we were both like racing to the
starting
gate.
Oh, wow.
And they were both like big kaiju monsters versus robot movies. And Tim's would have been fantastic. But, the Pacific Rim started shooting, and we're like, well, we can't.
So how much time had you invested on that at that point?
A year.
Oh, my gosh.
A year of my life. And that's the story you'll find for a lot of sort of the A-list screenwriters is there are a bunch of movies that they've killed themselves on that never shoot. And that's the really heartbreaking thing. At least as an actor, if you are in a movie, there's a pretty good chance that your movie will come out.
Somewhere.
A director's movie will come out, but the writer's movie often never does come out. Or if it does come out, sometimes it's vastly different than what you ever intended.
God, can you imagine what percentage of just raw gold is just sitting unproduced because of some legal business affairs thing or some studio head just wasn't in the mood that day or something.
Or studio head changes a lot. And particularly because I tend to write these big, expensive, blockbustery, tentpole-y kind of movies, it's a binary choice. Either you're making it for $100 million or you're not making it. And a lot of times you're just not making it. And that's heartbreaking.
Well, of course, because I think that is the other thing that if someone wants to write in the entertainment business, and television is maddening, but film is like an order of magnitude more maddening. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can spend 3 years trying to get a TV show made. You can spend 10, 15 years trying to get a movie made. And so you're trying to balance, how are you balancing out, or what advice would you give to writers for balancing out that idea of keeping your artistic integrity intact and your voice intact, which is very important. But obviously when you're working on bigger budget things, there's a lot of compromise. Mm-hmm. And then balancing out just the business part of just all the shitty business part, which, quite frankly, doesn't give a shit about the art part at all.
No. I wish I had like the all-purpose advice that can get you through it. But if I had that advice, I would take it myself. Because even like to this last year, I'll spend a year working on a project that just will go south or go off the rails. And you can sort of anticipate some of the problems that are going to happen. We're going to go through this phase of a project where everything just gets crazy and people start to doubt their fundamental things. You can brace yourself and be ready for that. But you're never quite sure how it's going to turn. And so I guess I've just tried to take the approach of, I will continue to work on movies where it makes sense, where I have a vision for what it is, where I think they're actually going to make the movie. Mm-hmm. I think I did spend too many years pursuing the movies that were a really interesting idea, but probably would never have the momentum to actually get made. Mm-hmm. Whereas they may have bought that book, but they're not actually going to make that movie. And so I could write a great version of that adaptation, but they're not actually going to make it. And that's the reality. So I have to sort of balance, is this fascinating to me? Is it really interesting enough to the studio that they'll do it? And so if I can find that combination, great. But I'm also just trying to write and do things that are my own thing, that I can actually control myself. So part of the reason why I went off and wrote a book was so that I could actually write the final thing. Rather than making a plan for a movie, I can just actually write the book. And the book is the finished piece of art, the finished piece of material. I'm not waiting around for someone else to say yes to something.
Yeah, and that it is so important too. And I think that's why podcasting has been so great too, because it's like as many things as you can do that don't require permission, you really have to do those things to keep yourself spiritually fulfilled because the rest of the process. I mean, and even when you do get when something is getting made, for you, what is your experience with how does a finished product when something, and it's surprising to me that anything ever does get made, but what is your experience with the finished product lining up with what the script is that you turned in.
Yeah, some days, sometimes it's night and day. Like, Go is an example of, like, it's very much the movie I wanted to make. And so, you know, I was there for every moment of production. I was there all through the editing room, through the reshoots, through everything to sort of get it into its final fighting form. Big Fish, I wasn't there for very much of the shooting at all, and yet it's very much the movie I hoped to make. Those are the great fantasy scenarios. But, like, I have my name on some movies that I've never seen because I read the final script that they shot, and it was not at all what I had intended. It wasn't even close to what I intended, and that is just devastating.
Because everyone's like, oh, John August wrote that, and you're like, he didn't though.
Yeah.
He took a pass at it early on, and then someone else came in.
Yeah.
And so talk about that, because that I think is people don't really understand, because it's just people just don't fully understand how the process works. So you write a script, your name is on it, you know, per union rules, through WGA rules, your name is on that script because you wrote the first iteration of it. So what happens from there? And how does something get so deconstructed beyond recognition, but your name is still on it and there's nothing you can do about it?
So ultimately, our system for figuring out whose name should be under written by or screenplay by is it's determined by the Writers Guild of America. And I'm on the WGA board. I strongly believe in the WGA. And it is the best system we've been able to come up with for fairly deciding who should get writing credit for a movie. But it's still incredibly frustrating. So if you see a movie and it says written by and there's one person's name, either that person really was the only writer, or it went through an arbitration process and the three anonymous screenwriters who read through all the scripts said, like, okay, this writer, which is just, you know, it was writer A on the scripts they read, this writer is responsible for the by far the majority of the screenplay that's actually shot. This writer deserves credit. And if there was another writer or another three other writers, they worked on the movie, but their name isn't on it, because that's just the nature of how we do the credit systems for this. So if you see somebody listed on a credit and it says story by and then a screenplay by credit that's separate, then they probably worked at different times. The story by credit person probably was an earlier writer and didn't end up shaping a lot of the story of the final script. Okay. But enough stuff had changed along the way that the screenplay credit went to a different writer. I've been the first writer. I've been the fifth writer on movies. You know, in every case, you try to be as respectful to everybody else who was on the project before you or after you. But you're trying to create the best movie you know how to make. And so that may mean changing things, because that's the nature of the movie that they're trying to make right then.
But at a certain point, if a movie gets released and your name's on it, and you must have had this experience where you're like, oh my God, I'm not responsible for this. I don't want to take the heat. I don't want people saying, like, oh, John August wrote a crappy movie because, you know, it passed through five people's hands and a bunch of studio notes and no one could agree on anything, and that's just the nature of it.
Unfortunately, that is the nature of it. And so, you know, I think you always be generous in your assumptions, I would say, is that, like, don't assume that that line of dialogue that you hate in a movie was the fault of the person whose name is credited as the writer, because you just don't know. There may have been another writer. The actor may have changed the line. The director may have changed the line. There may be some reason why that really dumb moment is there, or like things edit different. Things just don't happen sort of the way you hope. If they had released the first cut of Go that I saw, I wouldn't have a career. I was physically ill afterwards.
Oh no!
It was so devastating. I felt like I had been poisoned. And but then we went back and we sort of looked at what we actually had shot. We sort of got through it. We did some reshoots. And then I was really happy with the movie. And I think people don't understand how much iteration happens to get something to turn out well.
Well, and it's also part of the reason why I feel like I'm very forgiving and supportive. Like, when I see a movie, you know, especially a low-budget movie, that, you know, if there's parts that suck, then you go, well, maybe they did the best they could. You know, there are so many things that have to come together. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a certain amount of universal serendipity that has to befall the production for us. Like, oh, everyone was on the same page and they all had the same vision, and it didn't rain the day they needed it to not rain. Uh-huh. And all the actors showed up sober and everyone was in a good mood, you know, or whatever it was, whatever magic needed to happen. And it makes me really appreciate great filmmaking so much, just knowing how hard it is to even get a group of people to agree in the same ballpark about what's being made.
It's also why, when you see stories of, like, troubled productions, to take those with huge grains of salt, because I've been on like happy sets where the movies were terrible, and I've been on incredibly tumultuous sets where things turned out great. And the tumultuous sets are sometimes everyone there is obsessed with making the best movie, and they may disagree on how they're going to make the best movie, but they all really care. It's the sets where people don't really care at all that tend to be really happy, because it's like senioritis, like sure.
Hey, you know what? Whatever.
Yeah, that was good enough.
It's fine. Yeah, good enough. That was good enough. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, whatever. I mean, how common is it for a screenplay writer to be involved throughout the entire process that way? I feel like it's just sort of maybe not.
It's the nature of the production and the director often. And so if you have a director who's really inclusive, who wants you there, who like is trying to bounce ideas off you, you're going to be around. Or if the director is struggling, they may have you around to sort of be a backstop and to sort of help out those situations. There have been movies where they will fly me in to sort of do some triage and rescue on things, where they'll send me in to like meet with actors independently of the director. And like those are really problematic situations. And that's where I'm getting paid, not really kind of just for writing, but also for the psychological aspect of like, I'm a person who can stick into a room with some really big egos and survive. And that's just, there have been movies where it's just like, usually there's like one 800 pound gorilla, but like there's some movies I've gone into which is like, okay, this is Gorilla City. Like I'm just, you know, and you're just
trying to be Jane Goodall.
Yes. And so you're just, they'll put me in there because like I can take it and I can make everyone feel comfortable, like that I'm hearing them and that I can give them what they need in order to be able to make
that. That is an excellent piece of advice, is that you know, as a writer or even a producer, I did a panel at a class at UCLA for a friend of mine, Tom Noonan, who's as a, you know, he, I don't know if you've done his class before there, but you know, he does a class at, I went to UCLA. I was very excited to do it. I've worked with Tom years and years and years ago. And, you know, I was telling them, like, you know, as a producer, your job is to basically be a creative problem solver, and you have to be a multi-tool. Some days that's counseling people. Mm-hmm. Some days that's making sure that a writer is communicating with the right person, or a studio is communicating with another person, that it's not, that the sticking point isn't like, well, the lawyers aren't talking.
Yes.
So that's freezing up the process. So you need to figure out how to slip in wherever you can and just bridge the gaps and be the connection point, because you're the center of that pinwheel. And so that is a very hard job, because you have to manage so many different infrastructures and personality types and somehow make it all work.
So you describe it like a producer as a multi-tool. What I've always found is that on any given production, and tell me if this happens with TV shows as well, that there's a couple different kinds of producers you need. And sometimes you can stick them in the same body, but often they're broken out. And so you need one person who is just that peacemaker, who can get the actor out of their trailer and sort of make everything calm.
Yeah.
You need one who's just like the general, who's basically like making the trains run on time, mm-hmm. who just keeps everything click, click, clicking, because otherwise it's just chaos. But then you also need that one guy who's just a little crazy. And I would describe it as like, you know, it's like you have a dog and you have a ball. It's like, you see this ball? Get this ball. And you throw the ball as hard as you can, and that producer will just knock down everything in your way.
Right.
That function is a really crucial thing. And sometimes I see movies or things that aren't working quite right, and I feel like they never found that ferocious dog.
You're just talking about a D&D party. You need someone good at hand-to-hand. You need a melee. You know, like you need someone hand-to-hand combat.
Just take the hits.
That's right.
Absolutely. You need the barbarian. You can send
You need a barbarian. You know, you need an archer who can fire long distance. And sometimes you just need someone to go in there with a club.
Yep, absolutely.
And clear it all out so that the wizard can come in and cast the spells.
Yeah, so the wizard tends to be like the filmmaker. Like, you know, the wizard needs a lot of protection because it's very fragile. But you need to have somebody there and you got to keep the wizard healed.
Every production needs a tank.
Like, you gotta have a tank.
Well,
are you still playing? Are you playing D&D now at all?
I haven't played for a little while, but you know, like I tend to gravitate toward the RPG type games. Well, you know, like the open world RPG. Like I played the shit out of Zelda, and I played Skyrim, and I started fucking around with Overwatch, mm-hmm. and you know, but I did have a D&D group, which I recommend for anyone who enjoys gaming, because that's so much about like that immediate community of like five people that you're playing with, mm-hmm. and anything where you really have to engage with people and mm-hmm. sort of force your imaginations together is such a great thing to do. But yeah, I still play, and you're right that in a production, you know, someone has to be the person that's really good at dealing with the studio or the network or the crew there or the, like you said, the line producer who needs to make sure the schedule, the trains all run on time. And or there's a person, you know, there's also like the person that can attract.
Yes.
You know, like a magnet who can get good talent. And that's,
oh, yeah,
you know,
that's
like
all
they're
do.
A good connector. But that's all they do. So that's why when people are watching and they see like, fuck, there's like nine EPs on the show. It's like, yeah, but they all, you know, for the most part, a couple of them probably just got credits.
Yeah, they're managers. Somebody's manager.
Didn't have to do jack shit. But for the most part, it's because you need that many different types of people to pull all of these elements together to make a thing.
Yeah. So on those big movies where I get sent in, I'm kind of the cleric. I'm just there to sort of, I'm just there to sort of heal the wounds, make sure everyone's like,
you sit down with your sword, your paladin, and you just sort of pray by the, all right, we will heal these wounds.
Yes. And lay on some hands, make everyone feel better about
it. Are you still playing?
I was still playing. And so I'd not played for years, but now I have a group that we play once or twice a month. All screenwriters. It's fantastic. We're playing 5th edition. So I've DM'd a little bit, but I've mostly been playing. So I have a I have a gnome monk. She's awesome. And named Gilly Greenleaf. And I also have a paladin named Bao Lin. So it's fun.
Yeah, and 5th edition's like quicker, right? So you can you don't... You can get together with a group and maybe just like bang out a quick campaign or
It really depends on sort of the nature of your DM and sort of how you're doing stuff. But they've made some really smart optimizations that sort of feel like the D&D of my high school, but like without the charts. And they just made some really basically they learned a lot from other games that had come after them, and they sort of took the best ideas. And God bless them.
Oh my God, I can't imagine a group of screenwriters playing D&D.
Oh my God,
we're fantastic.
Yeah, we're very into characters, so the narrative style things are great.
And of course, the best part of the D&D game is when you sit around and give each other's character notes.
Oh, you have to. Yes, you have to.
I didn't really understand. So when your elf entered the pub, did you really? You know, I really just wasn't understanding the motivation behind that.
Yeah.
Is there anything you think you could go and tighten that up a little bit?
Yeah,
sure,
yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah,
back.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to go back in and do like your revision pass of the campaign.
The best part is the, you know, whoever's DMing does the write-up of the night to plan for the next thing. And so just the write-up of like what actually happened is great. So it's like it's you know, obviously the treasure and loot, but really sort of like what sort of happened story-wise over the course of the night. And those are the best.
Have you written like an RPG foundation of a movie?
No, not really. And so I would love to, but you know, I think when you see like the D&D kinds of movies or the Warcraft movies that they try to do, it ends up being a lot to try to set up, and by the time you've set everything up, it's very hard to get story going. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to. It's just I've never been approached with one.
Yeah, because it's how do you establish the world, and then once the audience understands the world and the rules of the world, how do you establish the characters, and then how do you get people to care about those characters in a meaningful way? So that then you give a fuck about the quests that they have to do and how many quests are happening at the same time. Is it too much stuff? And then you have to do that in, you know, two hours.
Well, it's basically the fundamental difference between a game which is being played and, you know, a movie or TV which you're watching people do the thing. And so when you're in the game, you get to be one of those people. So you're in that, you're experiencing it firsthand. In a movie or anything that's on a screen, you have to stand back and watch all these people do these things, and that's just really tough. Even the Lord of the Rings movies, you find they really just pick individual characters to follow, and like you're with them through this part of the journey. But rarely are you like watching a group of five people doing anything in that whole story.
What are some common mistakes that young writers make? That if you read a script, you go, "Aha! I can already tell you." Like, you know, is it too much dialogue, or is it cramming too many characters in one thing, or is it too many goals for the storyline?
There's a lot. The big phenomenon of they've read a couple of screenplays, but they don't really understand the format, which is fine. It's a weird format. It's hard to understand how to write that minimally, but also sort of convey everything. They'll tend to they'll have like 10 minutes of story figured out, and then like it'll just sort of churn its wheels for a long time. They'll have forgotten to actually begin a journey. It won't be about like a character on a one-time thing. It's just a bunch of stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And so they have a very hard time telling the story through the perspective of their main character. It ends up feeling like, oh, you know what? I watched The Godfather too. Or like, this is, you know, we're sharing the same references, but you're not actually telling a story.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think sort of the classic tale in television was that, you know, for a long time, you know, people would write, you'd write a spec and you'd send a spec in, and And for the longest time, there was sort of a trope of like people would try to tackle a Simpsons script.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, if you're a hardcore Simpsons fan, you understand the language of the show and you understand what everyone's idiosyncrasies are. So then they'd write a Simpsons script and they were just a fucking mess because it's rather than just sort of write a story, they were just writing like, and then Barney's burps and then this. And so it's – and how do you wrangle a world that's that insane and just focus it on a single storyline?
Yeah, and finding focus is true in any kind of writing. It's like, yes, you could do all these things, but you can't do all those things because then you're not doing anything. So you have to be very deliberate about what you're choosing to do and really always be aware of what the audience knows at the time. And the trick of all writing is that you know where you're going, but the reader can't know where you're going. The reader has to be able to trust that you know where you're going, but you can't be tipping that to them. You can't be getting ahead of them. And so making sure the experience, sentence by sentence, line by line, is rewarding because, you know, they'll only give you, you know, a few minutes and then they're like, oh, you know what? I'm done. I'm going to change the channel or I'm going to just stop reading the script.
Did you ever take the McKee story structure class?
I've never taken McKee. I know some of the basic mechanics.
Jacinda and I took it together.
Fantastic.
In like 1997.
Yes.
It was at the Pacific Design Center. We went and, you know, and he was kind of a character. So it was just like the class was really fun. But I still remember stuff that he said back then about, you know, not trying to avoid write. Like whenever I see jokes in an action line, I barb a little bit because he railed against that so hard. He was like, and also writing metaphors in like a description. It's like, no, you need to, you know, don't, it was like the example he gave was like the sun set like a cat's eye in the sky. He was like, how the fuck do you shoot that? You know, it's like, make sure that you're very clear about what your action is. And also, you know, that your character has a very clear goal and that your you know, and that you're not spending 20 pages. Like if you're still setting up your world, like 20, 25 pages in, and there hasn't been anything that's actually happened yet, you're in trouble.
Yeah. So here's where McKee is wrong. This is where John says it.
This is great. I love McKee's wrong. Okay.
Is that, there is the school of thought, like you only literally shoot exactly what you can see and that it's, that screenplays are meant to be so minimal that it's basically just like, it's a template for sort of like, this is what we're going to see in the world. If you do that, people will stop reading your scene description. They'll stop reading the action because they'll know that there's nothing rewarding for them in the action. So then they'll only read the dialogue. And when people only read the dialogue, they miss most of what you're actually trying to do in the movie. So that's why you have to make sure those scene descriptions are actually interesting. And so, yes, you can't describe the sun being like a cat's eye. You can't use a lame metaphor. But if you have like a great metaphor that actually captures it, that's great. And I think the ability to use metaphor to describe things to folks is so fundamental. Like I went off and I directed one movie called The Nines. And what I loved so much about that process was figuring out how to communicate what I wanted to my different department heads. And so, you know, if I'm working with a composer, I'm not going to grab the keyboard and tell him what notes to play, but I can really describe with my, you know, my words, with metaphors, this is what it feels like to me. Mm-hmm. If I'm talking to my DP, Nancy Schreiber, I can say, okay, this part of the movie, it sort of feels like you're two beers in on a great July night. And with that, she can say, oh, she gets what that is. And she has a whole sense of like what that means in terms of lenses and light and sort of color quality and stuff like that. But like, I don't have to tell her like, oh, I think we're really wide lenses or really tight lenses here. She can figure that out for herself. And so even back to scene description, if you have the metaphor that gives us that feeling, you know, each of those little things is going to fire those neurons in the reader's brain. It's like, oh, I get it. I like this writer. He values my time. And he's like, he's going to show me something good. Because there's always the instinct to just like set down the script. Because anything is more interesting than reading a screenplay.
Yeah. And I just turned in a pilot script. Mm-hmm. And there's one character that, you know, in our heads was very much against the way she was written, which thought was kind of funny about her. And so they were saying like, oh, this one character comes off really negatively. And so I just had to write in the description, like, note, this is going to come off negatively, but she is this type of character. Do not think this, think this. And really actually use it as a legitimate guide to explain, you know, and that I think alleviated some of the stuff in that.
You had Ricky Lindholm on recently, and she came on our podcast as well. And we were asking her the question about when she was staffing up for another period, like she's reading these scripts, like how many pages would she read? And she's like, maybe three.
Right.
And like basically if you haven't won her over in those first three pages, she's not going to keep reading because she's trying to read so much. And but you do have a sense of like what you're looking for. And when you see a writer who gets it, who just makes you fire in a certain way, you're so excited. And so, you know, I just always try to write something that's going to keep people so excited to keep reading. With Big Fish, you know, I remember talking to the woman who did the visual effects for us, who had to budget all that stuff. And when I first met her on set, she's like, "I hate you." I'm like, "Oh, that's it." And basically, she had been trying to finish the script for Big Fish and had not been able to budget like the back, like the last 10 pages, because she just couldn't get through it because it was just too emotional for her.
Oh.
And so you're trying to create the experience with just words on the page. What it would be like to sit in the theater watching that thing. Mm-hmm. And that was a case where I was able to do that. I was able to sort of like put you in the space if you had just watched this movie and were having this experience. And it's largely scene description. That's not dialogue that got you there.
Yeah. And that idea of creating experience, yeah, and also thinking about how you feel and how you kind of, I mean, obviously you can't force an audience to feel any way, but how you'd like them to feel. Thinking about feeling is very good because that is ultimately what makes you connect to anything.
Absolutely. If there's not an emotional connection to something, then it's just a curiosity. Then it's an article.
Right.
It's not a piece of like filmed entertainment if it's not making you feel something.
Right. And so are there things that you still feel like you have yet to explore? I mean, how many scripts have you written? 50?
Probably 50.
I mean, do you ever get to a certain point and you go, "I just don't know what else I'm going to say,"
yeah,
you know, but you still have to somehow find a way to force yourself to sit down and write?
I'm not running out of like things to say, but I will confess, I'm getting a little tired of just the format and tired of like the patterns that I just know are necessarily going to happen in terms of just the process. And so I was getting less excited to sort of like write that next screenplay because I just know how to do it. There's a thing called expert rigidity where like you get so good at something that's no longer challenging for you and stops kind of becoming interesting for you, which is like you're just in a routine. Like, mm-hmm, you just know I know how to juggle these plates, but like I'm kind of tired of juggling plates. And so I'll always, you know, go off and try to find, well, what do I not know how to do? Because when you're brand new at something, it's really exciting because it's really hard. And so I like to look for things that I can be a beginner at. And invariably, they do involve some kind of writing, but just really different kinds of writing. And that's exciting for me because I don't know if I can do it.
Right. And also, what can be very surprising is because you have all of this skill set built up over years and years and years, that some of that transmutes to,
oh, yeah,
other areas. We go, "Oh, wow, well, I guess, you know." And that's where innovation happens, mm-hmm, where you're really being able to be interdisciplinary and apply things from one area to another area. That's where new things get created.
Absolutely. And where you can be the connecting point of like, "Oh, like that guy's a really genius composer. That guy's really funny. They could make a funny song together. Like I know how to do this from like software development I've done. And that guy, I bet he could actually help me out in doing this other thing." And that's really cool when you can sort of make those kind of connections happen. Like the guy who, I developed these things called Writer Emergency Pack. It was the first Kickstarter I'd ever done. And that was really cool. I was just really curious how Kickstarter worked. So I made out this product and it ended up being like the biggest card Kickstarter until Exploding Kittens, which just blew it all away.
The Writer Emergency Pack.
Writer Emergency Pack. And but doing that, I met the guy who ran NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month.
Yeah.
And then years later, I ended up doing a NaNoWriMo, and that became my book. And then I talked with him on the podcast, and now he's doing a live show with me. So it's weird. Like the people from different facets can sort of come back at you in interesting ways.
NaNoWriMo, by the way, I feel like everyone knows what it is, but basically is it December or November?
It's National November Novel Writing Month, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's basically you have a month to write a book. And
that's what I did.
And you write every day and you go and do it and you don't have time to judge it. You just sit down and you just make it.
You plow through it. And it was a good framework for me to start working on this book, but also I think it's a good framework for people just to like be less precious about, you know, "Oh, if I don't get my book published, it's a failure." It's like, no, like just actually make the thing to try making the thing. And just, you know, it gives you a framework for just like, just go for it. Just try, because you're not really losing anything.
Precious is ego. When you get precious about something, that's ego.
Yeah.
But it also, you know, it comes from a good place. You care about it so hard.
Yeah.
But it can be, I think one of the biggest challenges for any creative person, not just a writer, is just being able to create in spite of themselves.
Yeah.
Because you will... There are more barriers that you put up than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
That you might put off to like, oh, the, you know, you create these magical thinking narratives like, well, the business doesn't want me and no one likes me and no one, this is dumb and everyone, I never get it. And like, okay, maybe that's true, but you're probably inventing a lot of that and accepting it as fact. And, mm-hmm. you know, like if you can't figure out a way to just write in spite of yourself or create in spite of yourself, then you're just going to be bitter and angry.
Yeah. I never want to sort of sell people on the false promise that like, oh, if you just work really hard, you're going to have success. Because I know people who worked really hard, who worked harder than I have, who haven't had success. And I don't have a good explanation for why that is. But I can tell you that there are people who I think actually have a lot of talent who didn't make it. And I can say like, well, I don't think you actually tried enough times. Or that you wrote something, you wrote one thing that was really, really good, but you wrote one thing that was really, really good, and you just didn't follow it up with the next thing. And that's ultimately, so I think, you know, what gets you, you know, into a career is like, is writing that thing and then writing the next thing and the thing after and just keeping it going.
Are you ever, I guess, would you ever be allowed to publish anything that never got made? Like just like, oh, hey, I wrote this. Someone might as well at least fucking read it because I wrote it.
Some of my dead pilots I have put up online, so to johnaugus.com, just because they're never going to get made, but they were they were great writing experiences. And part of the reason why I started my website, you know, 15 years ago was people would ask me these questions about screenwriting. I'm like, well, this is the answer. Let me write it up once and like send you to the link. And so I became like the Googleable link for like, how do I do this thing in screenwriting? And so in the library, I put up like some of my dead pilots just so people could see like, oh, that's what that pilot looked like. And, you know, they can read the pilot and like it or not like it, but at least they can see how it was formatted, like what some of the pitch documents were like. And so that's been helpful to folks. And I just be helpful if you can be helpful.
What makes a good pitch in mm-hmm. your opinion? Let's just say, I mean, I know film and television are a little bit different, but in general.
I think that the same thing holds true for both. It's if you had just seen something you absolutely loved, how would you tell your best friend, how would you convince your best friend that they have to watch it? And so in telling your best friend, you would say like, the general sense of the world, like what it's kind of about, who the main characters are, and then like what the really cool moments are. So you wouldn't focus on every little beat of it all. You would just like, you'd sell your passion about like what it is, what it's about, who's in it, and then the basic shape of the story. And that can telescope from being, you know, the 30-second elevator pitch to the full 20-minute pitch. But it's mostly you're selling your excitement about this thing that you want to exist, that in your head already does exist. You're just trying to get people to see the movie you have in your head. Or in the case of a TV show, like this is what it would feel like to have this TV show on the air. This is what's so exciting about it.
When we pitched the sitcom, one of the things that I did was I went in with a stack of headshots, basically,
great.
Of comics who are all friends of mine, a lot of whom I know are already working on shows.
Yeah.
But it allowed them to visually see and just get an instant picture rather than just hearing with
yeah.
words, this person is quirky in this way, like instantly go, oh, okay, 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 okay. And then from a writing perspective, kind of having them in my mind helped us
yeah.
make, you know, character choices that were very specific rather than, you know, so you don't suffer from the problem of like, how do I distinguish between these three or four characters? They all kind of sound the same.
Having some sort of visual can be really helpful on pitches because then they can, after you're sort of done with your main party pitch, they can point back to the board and like oh, this thing. If there's a character they want to talk about, they can point to it on the board or point to that whatever that artwork was. It just gives something else for them to focus on and helps them structure their thoughts as you were structuring your pitch.
Yeah, and so I'm writing a movie with my friend Heather Ann Campbell, who's awesome, and I love her approach to it because we just started hanging out and she was like, let's just think of fun gags mm-hmm. in the movie
yeah.
and then we'll just connect them.
Yep.
And I had never really, it seems so obvious when she said it, but it never occurred to me to write that way before. So we had so much fun coming up with gags mm-hmm. that are now like in a big,
yep.
and then so, you know, once we're ready to get to that next phase, it's just going to be like, okay, you know, how do we just put the screws in that hold all these things together?
And so what you're describing is, I think my frustration with McKee and some of the other screenwriting gurus is that they always describe like this perfect template for what a movie is. And that you have to figure out like, so what are like, where are we at in these arcs? And like, you know, here are the clothespins that are hanging things off of. And they're ignoring the real principal thing. Is like, is this actually enjoyable to watch at any given moment? Is it funny? Is it serious? Is it terrifying? Like, what is actually happening moment by moment? And if it's not working moment by moment, you can have the most glorious structure of any movie ever written. No one will care. It won't work.
Well, yeah, because I'm, you know, not every filmmaker has knocked it out of the park every single time. There are some movies made by great filmmakers where you're like, well, it aesthetically, it's all there, but mm-hmm. there's just some, you know, there's just some magical thread that just didn't suck me in.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, but your favorite movies tend to often be the ones which aren't classically great structures, but the people who made the movie knew what they were doing. They had like a consistency of vision the whole time through. And so, you know, Caddyshack or Stripes or other things, like, they're not always the cleanest movies, but like, they're really smartly done in sort of how they are. Like, Clueless is one of my favorite movies. And it's just every moment of Clueless, you could sort of like take that, you could take a frame of Clueless and like put it in some fertile soil and it would grow into something that looks like Clueless. It's thoroughly clueless at every moment. and so, you know, it sounds like what you're doing with this sort of big docu-making is all those ideas could grow into the shape of the movie that you'd want to make. And right. That's the right way to start.
There was another thing I remember from McKee's class that I'm curious, I mean, again, I don't know if this works every time or not, but he basically introduced this idea that the value of the story should change. Like, at the end of every scene, mm-hmm. it should either go from a negative to a positive or then a positive to a negative. It's like mm-hmm. the character has a triumph, but then by the end of that scene, there's a loss that then they have to solve. In the next scene, that they have to turn back into a positive, and then back into a negative, and then back into a positive. I don't know if it was for every single scene, but it seemed like, if I remember correctly, and this was 20 years ago, it was on a micro level, each scene should alternate that way. Then each act should have its positive mm-hmm. to negative, and then the overall arc should go from one to the other at the mm-hmm. same time. So there were these value structures building larger value structures, building the overall value structure.
And that feels like the kind of thing which you could take a look at most movies and recognize, like, okay, that kind of happens in most movies. I think the danger is when you try to apply that to your own writing, it's like, oh, well, this scene has to do this. It has to flip from positive to negative. And so then you kill yourself to try to write that. That may not be the best version of that scene.
That's math.
Ultimately. And so what it is, I worry that sometimes we get so obsessed with, like, oh, this is structure, and structure is like math, and so we're going to calculate how to make the perfect movie. It's never a calculation. It's all instinct, and people don't trust their instincts, I think, a lot.
Is your face burning from the window?
It's burning a little from the window.
Let's scoot over. I could see as the sun begins to set. People love hearing mic work. Did you hear when they, I mean, all that writing stuff was great, but did you hear when they moved the editor to the table?
Oh my God, it was transformative. I mean, really, the whole podcast pivoted at that moment.
I had to do that. I relate to that.
Yeah.
That's something that everyone can relate to.
I will say sometimes on podcasts, it is exciting when you do catch those background sounds, make it feel like, oh, they're really in a place.
I try to leave as much of that stuff in as possible, but sometimes
it's annoying.
It's like sometimes if it's too much of a lull, then it, you know, the audience is like, okay,
get on with it.
All right, yeah. So it's like, you gotta figure out, like, how do you tighten it up to make sure you keep the rhythm.
So I've done a weekly podcast with Craig Mazin called Script Notes for, we're on 330 episodes, so not nearly as many as you, but a lot of episodes.
That's a lot.
And but we're always a Skype show, and so we're always just talking over Skype. And the early episodes, it was really tough for us to figure out, like, now I'm going to talk, now you're going to talk.
That dynamic sucks so hard. It's like a conference call. But everyone starts to talk at once, and then you back off.
But it's weird. Like, you know, over time, you get really good at it. And so, like, now it's just, like, it's so natural for us to be doing that. And, like, there's very little snipping, you know, it's all completely natural that we're able to carry on a conversation without any eye contact, without any of those normal social cues. I just get to know, like, okay, Craig's wrapping up this thought, and now it's my turn, and you send those signals.
Well, yeah, and I can already, I have noticed, even just in talking to you, that you have had a lot of training in this type of a structure, because you land a thought.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like I, or a lot of people, will, you know, there's it gets a little loose and then someone else will kind of fill in and then you kind of layer, but you're very definitive about and then and now I'm done. And to hear that it's, you know, like you do the same with Skype, it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you have to have some clear closure there or else you're talking at the same time.
Yeah, you know, early on in the podcast, people would say like, God, you know, everyone on the podcast just interrupts each other. And what I was trying to explain is like, look, or if people said like, why does this happen on the podcast? Or why did you ask this? Or why did you not ask this? And I started saying to people like, you as the listener, you're just hearing the audio. You're not getting all of the information. Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of visual information. And when you're in front of someone, you see their body language, you see where their eyes are going. Sometimes, you know, we just had to learn how to, and we still fuck, I still fuck it up sometimes, but the way people's bodies move when they're about to wrap up a thought, sometimes you just miscalculate. But in general, there is a tremendous amount of visual information, which is why it's difficult for me to, I need that visual information. So I can't do it over Skype or phone or anything because it just completely throws me off.
So have you done any monologue shows where it's like there's no other guest, where it's like just you talking to the audience? Have you done any
of those? No one would listen to that.
So it's really hard. So the launch, the thing I'm doing now, that is more of a classic NPR or sort of like a Planet Money or a startup show where I'm just talking directly to you.
I don't think anyone would want to just listen to me talk.
Hard. It's so challenging. Like Tim Ferriss does those kind of shows too. And it's really hard because without a person to talk with, you end up in this sort of weird limbo space where I'm just talking to this imaginary person who's about 12 inches in front of me.
Yep.
And it's strange.
And they're gagged, so yeah, they absolutely can't respond.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're asking these questions, but they're not answering. So that's been like one of the weirdest things to try to learn how to do because I'm used to, you know, a conversation, even if we're in different rooms, or a live show. And live shows are great fun because then you have the feedback of the audience. But to have this just this void is so crazy.
Well, and so talk a little about your new podcast.
So the new podcast is called Launch. It is the process of me writing this book. And so about 2 years ago, I said, you know what, I'm going to just go off and write this book. I'd had this great conversation with this middle grade author about adapting his book into a movie. And said, I decided by the end of this phone call, you know what, I think I just actually want to write my own book. And so that night, it was on October 30th, 2 years ago, I started writing. That became the first chapter of this book. In that NaNoWriMo, I ended up writing 6 chapters. I sold the book. And at the same time, I started recording interviews with all the folks I was talking with. So my agents, ultimately, when I sold the book, the editors, other authors, and just started charting the entire process. And so I had all this tape, and I realized, like, well, that's probably a show. That feels like a podcast. And so I was able to sell it as a podcast. And we're doing six episodes, the first 4 of which are out now. So first episode is just the idea of the book to getting an agent. Second episode was selling it to Macmillan, dealing with the editor. Third episode was the cover of the book, getting that all figured out. Talking to the audiobook guy, which was really cool. Nerding out over like the grammar and the fonts because I had strong opinions on all that stuff.
Do you use Grammarly?
I people love Grammarly. I've not gotten into it. You love it.
I love it. Grammarly, for people who don't know, is basically a plugin. Mm-hmm. It's an app too, yeah. but it's a plugin. You know, I have it plugged into Chrome, and it in the same way that it's grammar check. It's,
yeah.
It's the way that spell check works, and it's not 100%, you know, just because people speak very colloquially, you know, especially in emails.
Yeah.
But you know, I love knowing like, oh, I should put a comma right there.
Yes.
After. Honestly. Comma, yeah. Or, you know, hyphenating a word or overuse of a word or something, you can pull it into the Grammarly framework and it'll give you, and it'll get super nerdy on you if you want it to.
Yeah, like
if you
want to
be
nerdy.
Really grammar perfect at this. Right. So anyway, I didn't know if you used Grammarly, but I think
well,
it's great.
So what was interesting about this book is that this is the first time I'm dealing with copy editors who are like going through and they're literally like, they'll challenge you on any given word. And so here's an example of something that I faced. Was let's say you are in a room, and at the far side of the room, there's a door, and you are moving in a direction that will ultimately take you to the door. You would say, I am moving blank the door. What would you say for that blank?
I'm moving toward the door.
You would say toward. I would say towards.
Oh, yeah. Toward, towards, beside, besides.
And so they went through and they changed all of my towardses to toward. And I went mental on them. And so then I had this deep rabbit hole. Like, why do I say towards? And it turns out it's a British thing, but it's also a Colorado thing. So where I grew up, we say towards. And
oh my gosh!
And it's a thing you would never notice until you have to like deal with all the changes they're making into your book.
That's so funny. And then because also it's there's I remember that too from when my book got edited and I had to explain like, look, this has to feel like me.
Yes.
And this is how I talk because I want when people are reading this book, I want them to hear my voice in their head.
100%.
And so if you make it. I'll never forget this. We were up at Hearst Castle and we were in one of the rooms and there were these perfectly laid tiles.
Yeah.
And WR was very obsessive about Hearst Castle, obviously. And the woman who was showing us around, who was great, her name's Mary, she's awesome, said he actually hated these tiles because they were too perfect. And so the imperfection, like the individuality wasn't there. It was a very cookie cutter, and it was different than other parts of the tile and other parts of the house. And I always took that as a much grander lesson about individuality, and there is no artistry in perfection. Whatever you do, whether it's writing or performing or whatever it is, you should really embrace those imperfections because that's what makes it unique.
That's what makes it your voice. And so even though I wasn't going to read the audiobook aloud, I needed to be able to read those sentences and actually have them make sense. And so sometimes they would make these changes and they'd make them correct, but they weren't correct in a way that I would ever say them. And
right.
So we'd have to sort of – I'd rewrite it until it was actually a thing that I could say that was also okay for the book. But that part, like, it sounds tedious, but it was actually amazing to sort of actually have that much attention being paid towards, like, is that comma really necessary there? And because in screenplays, no one gives a shit about, like, no one will ever challenge you over a comma in a screenplay. And they're trying to change everything else. Like, does it have to be a laundromat? And like, it says laundromat.
The movie's called Laundromat.
Yes. And so that kind of thing was great. But the most fun part of this whole process, that was episode 4 of the podcast, was I got to go to the book printing plant where they print my book. And did you see when they printed your book? Have you visited a book?
No, I didn't go.
It's amazing. And so I went to Harrisonburg, Virginia, and got to tour this place. And you see the whole process. So they go from a PDF to printing these plates, these big aluminum sheets of big aluminum sheets that have to be mounted on the presses. They're printing the signatures, the individual little packets of the paper. Then it's going to the binding line. They're making the case. It was all so cool. I love all the process kind of stuff. And it was a top 10 experience of my life to see it all come together. Like, I would have loved I first watched them do a Clive Cussler book, and that was really cool. But then I see the whole process, like, for my own book, and like to grab the first copy of my book when it comes off the line was nuts.
I'm a smeller. Like, I would love the machine oil and the ink and everything.
Yeah,
like, that
it's a strong smell. It's loud and it has a strong, like, ink is made out of petroleum products, and so you smell that. But really what you smell is the glue. It's this protein glue. It used to be made out of horses. Now it's made out of, like, pharmaceutical waste. And
they're both bad.
They're both great. And you smell it. And it's great. And so I was talking to one of the linemen who's the guy who's printing the pages. And I'm like, this guy, Larry. It's like, so Larry, like, do you like books? He's like, no, man, I hate them. It's like I can't even walk into a bookstore because of the smell.
Oh yeah,
and like it's just to him, it's just too much.
It's work. He's got to be there time. Yeah, he doesn't want.
And so it reminded me of like a grip who like doesn't like movies. Like he loves he enjoys his work. He makes movies, but he's never going to watch a movie.
See, now why don't they make books that smell like things? If your book is about a laundromat, why can't it smell like a laundromat? We have the technology.
Oh, we had shrinky. We had that scratch and sniffs from our
scratch
childhood.
And sniffs.
Oh my god! Completely.
And you also mentioned shrinking inks, which I was also a big fan of.
I love shrinking inks. Melting plastic. They still do make shrinking inks.
They still make shrinking inks. They must.
Oh, they're so good. My daughter yesterday was doing. You know what perler beads are? They're the little round plastic beads, and you run an iron on them, and they firm down. We kind of missed them in our childhood, but like they're a big thing now.
Do you know what they are, Katie? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so, she had to make a gift for somebody. So she made a little basketball out of them. And I was upstairs ironing it to melt it down. Melting plastic. It's good.
It's and also great to inhale.
Oh, I love it.
All the time. Can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
How long ago did you adopt your daughter?
So we had her since she was by surrogacy. So
She
was surrogacy. So we had her since, there are no accidental gay births. So we... everything's super planned. We're planners. So, we had her by surrogacy, and it was amazing. And we had the most awesome surrogate in the whole world. And So our daughter's 12 now. So I've known her since she was, you know, three cells big.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm wondering how is the process for same-sex couples who want to either adopt or go through surrogacy? Is it a lot easier now than it was 12 years ago?
You know, I think, you know, it keeps changing. It keeps getting hopefully easier. You know what? We have so many friends who have kids by all sorts of different ways, and adoption is fantastic as well. And kids are just awesome. And I've loved being a dad, but I also super love babies. And I think a lot of men sort of admit, like, babies are awesome. And if I could have a job where, like, I could, like, take care of a baby for, like, 3 hours a week, I would be in heaven. I love
just
babies.
Just a comfort baby where you just get a baby for a few hours?
I mean, babies are like puppies, but kind of even better. They're just so awesome. And so, I always wanted kids. My husband, Mike, was pro-kid once I sort of talked him through the idea. And it's been great. It's been fantastic.
That's good. So how have you balanced the, you know, because what I know from everyone is like, well, once you have a kid, that's, you know, you are not number one anymore.
No.
You have to focus on the kids. So did that change the way that you write, or just the kind of the structure of how you craft
it? It changes the structure of your days a lot, because I was a person who would, you know, stay up all night writing, or, you know, just have late hours. And with a kid, you just can't do that, because you're a wreck for the kid. So I had to get much more onto like a more normal, like 9 to 6 kind of, you know, work day. And that was probably ultimately for the best. Like, you know, your time becomes much more valuable. And so, like, when I actually had time to write, I was going to write and I wasn't going to fuck around.
Right.
So that part was great. I think I basically stopped swearing. Like, even for me to throw in that one obscenity right there, that's really unusual. It's hard for me to sort of get back into it, because you break yourself of it.
Kids have the internet, though.
They do, I know. But, I mean, you just don't want to sort of accidentally introduce it too early on. But one of the best things was, like, she started reading really early on. So, like, you get to remember, like, oh, man, that's right, books. Books are cool. And so, like, she was an obsessive reader. And also we got to write the kind of book that she would like. And that was cool to be able to sort of be able to work on something like, because she's not going to see Go, but she could see she could read this book.
Well, the other idea of how do you, I mean, and this is, I guess this is just part of the key to success, but how do you motivate when you don't go to an office?
Yeah.
When your workspace is basically the stomach that you put your laptop on while you're lying in bed.
Yeah.
And let's say you don't have a deadline. You know, I am a believer that obstacles and structure are the best, and deadlines, because things that you have to work around force you to be creative. And when you can just write about anything whenever you feel like it, that is fucking really hard. So how do you motivate yourself, or how do you tell people to motivate when, you know, when their bed is their office, basically?
Yeah, I think you have to get out of bed and find some place to be your office, be it the coffee shop down the street or a library or some other place. You have to sort of take time to be selfish and do the thing that you want to do. If you feel like you have to go off and write, then you're probably not going to do it. But if you really want to go off and write, you'll find a reason to do it. If you love to golf, you'll find a way to golf. Want to do it and know that it's going to be hard. It's not, you're not going to want to do it every day, but make yourself, you know, get into a routine of doing it. A thing I found incredibly helpful for myself is what I call write sprints, which is basically, at the top of the hour, I'm going to write for an hour, and I'm not going to like check the internet. I'm not going to do anything other than work on this thing. And after an hour, I'm free to like get up and walk away. If I never get back to it, that's fine. But at least I will have done an hour. And so on Twitter, I'll say, like, you know, at the top of the hour, I'm starting a write sprint. Who wants to join me?
Huh.
And it helps, because you just know, like, oh, there's other folks who are doing the same thing. So I've created a social contract that I'm going to do this, and people are going to do it with me.
That's really great.
Yeah.
Man, that's really fantastic.
Yeah.
You must get this question if you're doing like seminars or whatever. What if I don't know what to write about? What do I write about?
Just start writing anything. Because the truth is, if you just start putting words together, they'll eventually form the shape of something that is interesting. Or if they don't, at least you've got some practice, you know, crafting stuff. But you don't have to have the master plan. I think people always just be like, oh, I'm going to outline my big novel and I'm going to write it. You're never going to write that novel. you have to actually start writing some stuff, and then you discover what it is, and you edit it, and then you just go through it again. Same like if you're working on a joke, you have a general sense of where the space of the joke is, but ultimately you're going to have to figure out, like, well, where would that actually go in a set? Like, how would I get into that? How would I get out of that? Like, what is it actually all about? Is there a bigger framework for it? well, at the start, you just have a joke. You just have a thing you want to say.
Yeah.
And don't worry about the context until you actually have the thing right.
Well, and sometimes what's helpful with stand-up is that if you don't know, you have that sort of blank moment. If you do it on stage, it's going to come out the way it's supposed to come out sometimes because you didn't think about it. It's just like it was in the moment and that's how it came out based on the relationship that, you know, but as a writer, that can be hard sometimes because you know, at least with an audience, you have there's a feedback, a bit of a feedback thing. But with writing, it's like, well, you're writing the audience in your head.
Yeah. It is the audience in your head. When I started writing this book, I literally did not know who some of the characters were until I was halfway through the sentence that introduced them. It was just like, just surprised me, and stuff would happen, and it became important stuff for the mythology of a 3-book series, and that's great when that happens. But you just have to trust yourself. Like, the stakes are very low. Like, so if it doesn't work, if it doesn't make sense, whatever. Like, you haven't wasted that much time. You will waste more time, you know, playing, you know, solitaire on your phone. So just do the thing. And I think people get so hung up about this fear of this perfectionism, this fear of failure, and all these other reasons not to write. You just got to start writing the thing, and maybe it'll be great, maybe it'll suck, but it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, part of it really is just getting into the process of it and just, you know, you might write for 2 weeks and think that everything you're writing is crappy, but then on the 15th day, something comes out of you that would not have come out of you had you not greased the wheels in your head for all that time. That it's, you know, maybe things you write that you can't do anything with now are answers to questions that you haven't asked yet.
When they do those retroactive studies where they look back at writers and like when they wrote and when they were most productive, when they wrote their best works, and what those writers were journaling about at the time, like sort of what their daily diaries were, they find there's actually not that much correlation between like, oh, they were at a peak of their life and they were so happy and they wrote these things. Like, the writers whose work you've read, they tend to just write a lot, and their best work sort of made it all the way through to now, and their stuff that wasn't so great, it disappeared.
Yeah, that's right. And so you don't remember it because it didn't stand the test of time.
Also, don't compare yourself to the best things that other writers have ever written. and so what you should aim for that, you should aim for like you should aim to be like, you know, better than the best Tarantino, but like don't pretend that if it's not better than the best Tarantino, that's not failure because there's all the silent evidence of all the stuff of that author that you've not read.
Well, that's also, then you're also chasing something else. Yeah. And I think, you know, when, if you're stuck on something, I think it'd be great to go really inward and get as personal as possible, because that again is where you get really unique and different than anyone else on the planet, because no one is the collective sum of experiences that you are. And, you know, and why a show like Seinfeld is so great, because, you know, they made the writers go in and like just talk about things that really happened to you, and we'll just work those, we'll build stories around that. So you have completely fresh, interesting, but absolutely relatable stuff, because it's based on very personal experiences, and people can tell when things are personal, and people can tell, you know, when things are... It was another thing McKee's class said was, you know, people write hacky when they haven't researched enough, or they don't know something well enough. They just sort of write the, you know, like, oh, okay, well, this is the lowest hanging fruit.
Well, the classic advice of like, write what you know, people take it the wrong way. So they'll say like, well, I'm a butcher, so I guess I can only write about butchers. That's not what it's about at all. It's write what you know. It's like, what is your internal personal experience? Like, do you know what it's like to have your heart broken, and for the girl that you've loved your entire life to be married to your best friend? Like, do you know what that's like? If you know what that's like, then that might be a thing for you to write about, because you know what that emotional inner experience is like.
Yes, and don't take for granted that, you know, if you go, well, I'm not going to write a, you know, a story about a heartbreak because there have been a million heartbreak stories. But it's like, yeah, but no one's told yours.
Yeah.
And you are what makes that different. You're the real commodity. It's not that thing. It's however you express that idea. One of the neatest things I heard was about how sometimes, you know, if a band is stuck and they can't figure out how to write a song, they will just write the shittiest, most broad, hackiest thing they can think of, because what can happen is, in their minds, they're judging before, like, oh, this is really hacky. But because they have a specific set of skills, it actually doesn't always come out hacky, or it leads them into a direction that they hadn't thought to go before because they had put up that wall.
Absolutely. And
they need to be
playing,
free.
Yeah, exactly. And playing against that thing that they were so afraid of, they actually discover the thing that they really love. The other thing I will say is that I will happily write out a sequence. I've always been happy to write out a sequence. So movies that we make, or TV shows, they're shot out of sequence. You shoot, like, you know, shoot scene 3 and
right.
scene 17. I will write that way too. And so if I'm writing from beginning to end and I get to stuff like I don't know what to do next, I'll happily write that moment in the third act or the second act or whatever. I'll write whatever's interesting to me on that day, because so often there'll be a scene that is just torture for you. Skip it. And write something you actually want to write, because ultimately you got to write the whole thing. And so even if it's like prose, if there's a section you don't know how to do, just skip ahead to something else. Just leave notes for like what that's supposed to be and write something else, because you got to just generate the material before you have anything to edit.
Also, the other thing that you're excited about writing might help inform the thing that you can't write. So it almost becomes like a Sudoku puzzle.
Totally.
Where you're like, oh, I needed this number before I could get that number.
It is. It's you know, literary Sudoku is what you're trying to do. And so sometimes I just don't have the energy to write that difficult scene. So like, I'll write the thing that's kind of basically people walking through doors. Like, it's not crucial stuff, but like, I can get that done. It's like a thing I can scratch off the list. Do that thing.
That's great. Now, the book Arlo in the Valley of Fire is out now.
It'll be out. It's out now. Yeah.
Yeah. By the time the podcast goes out now. And then your podcast launch.
Yes. And so I think we probably will have wrapped all 6 episodes by the time this is out. So you can binge them all.
Is your website still up, by the way?
Oh, my God. John Ox is still up. Yeah. So johnox.com. And Script Notes is the screenwriting podcast I do, so you can find that on the site or just iTunes or wherever you find podcasts.
So ever since, you know, now it's been a little bit of time since I changed the name of the podcast from Nerdist to ID10T, which is something that's happening tomorrow that you don't know about yet. But by the time this airs, this will happen.
I'm so excited.
Yes. So the podcast the name of the podcast is changing. It's not that I want the podcast to be different, but you know, something that I've been asking.
Well, you built an empire. So you got to make sure that the budget, we haven't talked about your empire building.
I don't know.
That's the thing I've just been really impressed. Like, you actually had a vision for like this thing that you're doing, but like there's more stuff that could be sort of under that general umbrella. So Nerdist Industries and everything you built, that's really cool.
Oh, I appreciate that. It was just finding ways to connect, not trying to do everything at once was very helpful, and starting something, kind of getting a feel for it, and then getting excited about, well, how can this evolve? And then if this evolves, or it's something that feels a little disparate, how does it connect?
Yeah.
And does it connect? And is it complementary? Oh, it is, or no, it's not. And so, that part to me, my career is very heavily based on SimCity.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I loved SimCity.
Yeah. You get to plan and organize.
Well, you plan and organize, but you're also building and you're connecting and you're establishing little areas that then all sort of connect together and form this unified organism.
I always built out the subway too big too soon.
I always forgot to send water to people.
Yeah, that was bad.
You're like, what is happening? I forgot to put water pipes under there. Yeah. Or you'd get to a point where you'd put in fucking roads, and you'd put in the electricity, and you'd put in the pipes, and you'd put in a bus station and a highway, and no one would show up. You're like, how do you attract these people? What do you need to do?
Yeah, you need heavy industry or something.
You need heavy industry. You need zoning, I found out. You need zoning. You need to put enough residential with enough industrial with some commercial so they can have businesses.
Yeah.
Then a school, then a police station,
but I'd
library.
Build these nice parks and they wouldn't be happy. Oh, you're sitting.
You're never happy. It sucks to be a politician. That's the only part about that. When it starts getting into like,
very true.
When you have to tax people, like my classic SimCity move was lower taxes.
For a while, yeah. Make people really happy.
And then you get people in, and then you jack them up as high as possible. You know, so
before
everyone moves out, then you still make a lot of money, and then you just, you know, kind of do that on repeat.
It's a very Banana Republic kind of way to run things, but yes.
And then occasionally, you know, when you're tired of it, you just send in a Godzilla or a Typhoon or something.
Oh, yeah, smash things down.
Wipe it all up and start over again.
I always build a prison out on the island. It's always fun to do that.
You know, I forget that we're almost exactly the same age, so that our reference points and our early gaming experiences were probably exactly the same.
Absolutely.
So one thing that I've been asking people is like, you know, in a culture where things can be feeling, you know, sort of toxic, we're focusing on a lot of negativity and toxicity. And of course, there certainly are negative and toxic things happening. But It's not the full scope of the world, I don't think. What's something that you're excited or joyful about right now that doesn't have to be related to anything that we've talked about?
I would say I was in a really dark place. So the short version is last year we moved to Paris just for the year. And so our daughter was in sixth grade, and we just did her sixth grade year there because I'm a writer and I could work in Paris. And so I missed all the election stuff and all sort of the doom of that. But I'd feel it just on this weird time delay. And I was feeling really down. And then we went to the Women's March in Paris, and it was just amazing. And to see like, oh, there are people who care, and they still do. And so I think the thing which has been giving me sort of the most hope over this last year is just to see that there's people who will show up and do things. And, you know, you see some people live events we do for Script Notes, or you see people out on the street, but you don't sort of know what they're into. But then we see like a big crowd together. It was the first time I've been excited to see big crowds. I'm always like, I'm always afraid of big crowds. And then to see a big crowd together just to push for something was really cool. So that's the thing that sort of gives me hope and joy.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. I mean, and it is nice to see people doing things in the real world too.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
Because we're just Twitter avatars.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And also, you know, in people's busy lives, you know, maybe that day the only thing they had time to do was tweet.
Yeah.
And it is very hard to set aside time to then, you know, get in your car, go park, show up, be passionate, you know, stand up for something you believe in. That is a very, you know, like that's a lot of steps, and it's more steps than some people will take.
Yeah. And I'm an Eagle Scout, so I'm super patriotic. I'm super like, I just so strongly believe in the ideals of the country, and to see people out there pushing for those ideals is great. And it just sort of gets me back to that moment of sort of why we're all in this country together. So that's felt really good to me. That sense of principles, and reminding people what the principles are is important to me.
Well, I've absolutely enjoyed having you on.
Oh, thank you. It was
so great. And also, these years just fly by. It's like I see you and I'm like, oh my God, I don't think I've seen you like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But I'm glad that you're able to come on the podcast. And congratulations on the
Thank you. Thank you.
And everything that you're working on and raising you're on the precipice of the teen years.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in the teen years already.
Where it's... You know, it's a rough time to be a teen with all the internets out there. It's a rough time to be a teen. So good luck to that. That is a story that I'm sure will manifest at some point in your life.
No, it's great. I mean, she's an awesome kid, but like, you know, kids at that age, they're challenging because everything about their body is changing in ways, and their minds are changing.
Well, their brains are forming, and it's when they first start vying for independence.
Yes.
And who am I? And what is, you know, right when their hormones kick in, their identities start to form. They're still, you know, they will form for like the next 15 years, but they really, you know, like, and you know, unfortunately, you might get in the way of some of that because you're a parent and you want to protect your kids.
Absolutely. And her pushing back is part of the nature of, you know, development. So
you just try to remember that when
you do. Like, there's a reason why this is happening. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So you snuck out and you came back at 6 o'clock in the morning. This is just you expressing your independence.
Yes.
Everything's
in a safe
fine.
Way.
Yes. Great.
In Paris, she could take the metro by herself. She could like scoot herself to school by herself. And that kind of independence was fantastic. And so we're trying to find ways in LA that she can be independent. It's just tough.
Yeah, it's not quite the same.
Yeah, distances are further and it's challenging.
Yeah, and our public transportation system is not quite as centralized.
It is not.
So, and the city's just too big and too spread out.
Yeah.
Well, come back on again.
I would love to see you.
Is there anything that you're working on that you want to plug or talk about or just spoil that you're working on?
Just spoil? No, I think I have two more Arlo Finch books to do. And so that's one of the real challenges of selling a 3-book series is that it's a book a year. So it's like a TV show where like
God,
gotta come up with the next
yourself?
One. It was so much pressure. It was so much pressure, but that's how it is because you remember what it's like. You probably had a favorite book series and like
sure.
You don't want to wait, you know, 2 years between books.
No,
but
you'll
outgrow them. So I gotta do that.
You know, there's probably some middle ground between Stephen King and George R. R. Martin.
Yes, I'm trying to find that middle territory.
It's good to see you, John.
Good to see you, sir. Thanks.
Enjoy your burrito.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this, perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients, popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.